jerked his back. He screamed but kept shooting. If they hadn't been in water, that plasma would have melted the tires. Probably would have flash-fried them all. A burst of heat and a plume of smoke erupted next to Harland. For a split second, he thought the Covenant gunners had found their mark, that he was dead. He screamed incoherently, his thumbs jamming down the chain gun's trigger buttons. The Banshee he was aiming at flashed, and then became a ball of flame and falling shrapnel. He turned, his breath hitching in his chest. They hadn't been hit. Cochran knelt next to him. One arm clutched his stomach, and the other arm hefted the jackhammer launcher on his shoulder. He smiled with blood-stained lips and pivoted to track the other flyer. Harland ducked, and another missile whooshed directly over his head. Cochran laughed, coughing up blood and foam. Tears of mirth or pain, Harland couldn't tell, streamed from his eyes. He collapsed backward and let the smoldering launcher slip from his hand. The second Banshee exploded and spiraled into the jungle.
"Two more clicks!"
Fincher shouted.
"Hang on!"
He cranked the wheel, and the warthog swerved out of the stream bed and bounced up the hillside, up and over, and they slid onto a paved road. Harlan leaned over and felt Cochran's neck for a pulse. It was there, weak, but he was still alive. Harlan glanced at Walker. He hadn't moved, his eyes squeezed shut. Harlan's first impulse was to shoot him right then and there. The goddamn gold-bricking cowardly bastard almost cost them all their lives. No. Harlan was half amazed he hadn't frozen up, too. HQ was ahead, but Corporal Harlan's stomach sank as he saw smoke and flames blazing on the horizon. They passed the first armed checkpoint. The guardhouse and bunkers had been blasted away, and in the mud were thousands of grunt tracks. Farther back, he saw a circle of sandbags around a house-sized chunk of granite. Two Marines waved to them. As they approached in the warthog, the Marines stood and saluted. Harlan jumped off and returned their salute. One of the Marines had a patch over his eye, and his head was bandaged. Soot streaked his face.
"Jesus, sir," he said. "It's good to see you guys."
He approached the warthog.
"You got a working radio in that thing?"
"I'm not sure,"
Corporal Harlan said.
Who's in charge here? What happened?"
"Covenant hit us hard, sir. They had tanks, air support, thousands of those little grunt guys. They glassed the main barracks, the command office. Almost got the munitions bunker."
He looked away for a moment, and his one eye glazed over.
"We pulled it together and fought 'em off, though. That was an hour ago. I think we killed everything. I'm not sure."
"Who's in charge, Private? I have a critically wounded man. He needs evac, and I have to make a report."
The private shook his head.
"I'm sorry, sir. The hospital was the first thing they hit. As far as who's in command, I think you're the ranking officer here."
"Great," Harlan muttered.
"We've got five guys back there."
The private jerked his head toward the columns of smoke and wavering heat in the distance.
"They're in firefighting suits to keep from burning up. They're recovering weapons and ammo."
"Understood," Harlan said.
"Fincher, try the radio again. See if you can link up to SATCOM. Call in for an evac."
"Roger that,"
Fincher said. The wounded private asked Harlan,
"Can we get help from Firebase Bravo, sir?"
"No," Harlan said.
"They got hit, too. There's Covenant all over the place."
The private slumped, bracing himself with his rifle.
Fincher handed Harlan the radio headset.
"Sir, SATCOM is good. I've got the Leviathan on the horn. This is Corporal Harland."
He spoke into the microphone.
"The Covenant has hit Firebase Bravo and Alpha HQ and wiped them out. We've repelled the enemy from Alpha Site, but our casualties have been nearly 100%. We have wounded here. We need immediate evac. Say again, we need evac on the double."
"Roger, Corporal. Your situation is understood. Evac is not possible at this time. We've got problems of our own up here."
There was a burst of static. The voice came back online.
"Help is on the way."
The channel went dead. Harlan looked to Fincher.
"Check the transceiver."
Fincher ran the diagnostic.
"It's working," he said. "I'm getting a ping from SATCOM."
He licked his lips.
The trouble must be on their end.
Harlan didn't want to think of what kind of trouble the fleet could be having. He'd seen too many planets glassed from orbit. He didn't want to die here, not like that. He turned to the men in the bunker.
They said help is on the way, so relax.
He looked into the sky and whispered, They better send a whole regiment down here. A handful of other Marines returned to the bunker. They had salvaged ammunition, extra rifles, a crate of frag grenades, and a few jackhammer missiles. Fincher took the Warthog and a few men to see if he could transport the heavier weapons. They filled Cochrane with more biofoam and bandaged him up. He slipped into a coma. They hunkered down inside the bunker and waited. They heard explosions at an extreme distance. Walker finally spoke.
So, now what, sir?
Harlan didn't turn toward the man. He covered Cochrane with another blanket.
I don't know. Can you fight?
I think so.
He passed Walker a rifle.
Good. Get up there and stand watch.
He took out a cigarette, lit it, took a puff, and then handed it to Walker. Walker took it, shakily stood, and went outside.
Sir, he said, dropship inbound, one of ours.
Harlan grabbed his signal flares. He ran outside and squinted at the horizon. High on the edge of the darkening sky was a dot, and the unmistakable roar of Pelican engines. He pulled the pin and tossed the smoker onto the ground. A moment later, thick clouds of green smoke roiled into the sky. The dropship turned rapidly and descended toward their location. Harlan shielded his eyes. He searched for the rest of the dropships. There was only one.
One dropship? Walker whispered. That's all they sent? Christ, that's not backup, that's a burial detail.
The Pelican eased toward the ground, spattering mud in a 10-meter radius, then touched down. The launch ramp fell open, and a dozen figures marched out. For a moment, Harlan thought they were the same creatures he had seen earlier, armored and bigger than any human he'd ever laid eyes on. He froze. He couldn't have raised his gun if he had wanted to. They were human, though. The one in the lead stood over 2 meters tall and looked like he weighed 200 kilograms. His armor was a strange reflective green alloy, and underneath matte black. Their motions were so fluid and graceful, fast and precise, too. More like robots than flesh and blood. The one that first stepped off the ship strode toward him. Though his armor was devoid of insignia, Harlan could see the insignia of a Master Chief Petty Officer in his helmet's HUD.
Master Chief, sir!
Harlan snapped to attention and saluted.
Corporal, it said, at ease. Get your men together and we'll get to work.
Sir? Harlan asked. I've got a lot of wounded here. What work will we be doing, sir?
The Master Chief's helmet cocked quizzically to one side.
We've come to take Sigma Octanus IV back from the Covenant, Corporal, he said calmly. To do that, we're going to kill every last one of them.
Chapter 20 1800 hours, July 18, 2542, Military Calendar. Sigma Octanus IV, Grid 19 by 37. The Master Chief surveyed what was left of Camp Alpha. There were only 14 Marine regulars left, balanced against the 400 men and women who had been slaughtered here.
He said to Kelly, Post a guard on the dropship and put 3 on patrol. Take the rest and secure the LZ.
Yes, sir.
She turned to face the other Spartans, pointed, made 3 quick hand gestures, and they dispersed like ghosts. The Master Chief turned to the Corporal.
Are you in command here, Corporal?
The man looked around.
I guess so. Yes, sir.
As of 0900 standard military time, Nave Specwep is assuming control of this operation. All Marine personnel now report through our chain of command. Understand, Corporal?
Yes, sir.
Now, Corporal, brief me on what happened here.
Corporal Harland hunkered down and sketched rough maps of the area as he quickly recounted the brutal series of surprise attacks.
Right here, grid 13 by 24, that's where they hit us, sir.
Something's going on there.
The Master Chief scanned the crude maps, compared them with the area surveys displayed in his HUD, then nodded, satisfied.
Get your wounded inside the Pelican, Corporal, he said. We'll be dusting off soon. I want you to rotate by thirds on guard duty. The rest of your men should get some sleep. But make no mistake, if the Pelican gets fragged, we'll be staying on Sigma Octanus IV.
The corporal paled, then replied,
Understood, sir.
He stood slowly. The long day of combat and flight had taken its toll. The Marine saluted, then moved to assemble his team. Inside his sealed helmet, John frowned. These Marines were now under his command, and therefore part of his team. They lacked the Spartans' firepower and training, so they had to be protected, not relied upon. He had to make sure they got out in one piece. Another snag in an already dicey mission.
The Master Chief opened his comlink. Team leaders, meet me at the LZ in 3 minutes.
Lights winked on his heads-up display, his Spartans acknowledging the order. He looked around at the destruction. Thin sunlight reflected dully from the thousands of spent shell casings strewn across the battlefield. Dozens of shattered Warthog chassis bled trails of smoke into the hazy sky. Scores of burned corpses lay in the mud. They'd have to get a burial detail down here later, before the grunts got to the dead. The Master Chief would never question his orders, but he felt a momentary stab of bitterness. Whoever set these camps up without proper reconnaissance, whoever had blindly trusted the satellite transmissions in an enemy-held region, had been a fool. Worse, they had wasted the lives of good soldiers. Green Team's leader jogged in from the south. The Master Chief couldn't see her features through her reflective faceplate, but he could tell without checking his HUD that it was Linda by the way she moved. That, and the SRS-99C S2AM sniper rifle with Oracle scope she carried. She carefully looked around, verified that the area was secure, and slung her rifle. She snapped a crisp salute.
Reporting is ordered, Master Chief.
Red Team Leader, Joshua, ran in from the east. He saluted.
Motion detectors, radar, and automated defense is up and running, sir.
Good. Let's go over this one more time.
The Master Chief overlaid a topographic map on their helmets' displays.
Mission Goal 1. We need to gather intelligence on Covenant troop disposition and defenses at Côte d'Azur. Mission Goal 2. If there are no civilian survivors, we are authorized to remote detonate a Havoc tactical nuclear mine and remove the enemy forces. In the meantime, we will minimize our contact with the enemy.
They nodded.
The Master Chief highlighted the four streams that fed into the river delta near Côte d'Azur. We avoid these routes. Banshees patrol them. He circled where Firebase Bravo had been. We'll avoid this area as well. According to the Marine survivors, that area is hot. Grid 13x24 also has activity. Red Leader, take your squad in along the coast. Stay in the tree line. Green Leader, follow this ridgeline, but keep undercover too. I'll be taking this route. The Master Chief traced a path through a particularly dense section of jungle. It's 1830 hours now. The city is 13 kilometers from here. That should take us no more than 40 minutes. We'll probably be forced to slow down to avoid enemy patrols, but we should all be in place no later than 1930 hours. He zoomed into a city map of Côte d'Azur. Entry points to the city sewer system are... He highlighted the display with nav points. Here, here, and here. Red Team will recon the wharf areas. Green takes the residential section. I'll take Blue Team downtown. Questions?
Our communications underground will be limited, Linda said. How do we check in while keeping our heads down?
According to the Colonial Administration Authority's file on Côte d'Azur, the sewer systems here have steel pipes running along the top of the plastic conduits. Tap into those and use ground return transceivers to check in. We'll have our own private comm line.
Roger,
she said.
The Master Chief said, As soon as we leave, the dropship dusts off and we'll move here. He indicated a position far to the south of Alpha Camp. If the Pelican doesn't make it, our fallback rendezvous point is here. He indicated a point 50 kilometers south. ONI's welcoming committee has stashed our emergency SATCOM link and survival gear there. No one mentioned that survival gear would be useless when the Covenant glassed the planet. "Stay sharp," John said, "and come back in one piece. Dismissed." They saluted briskly, then sprinted to their tasks. He switched to Blue Team's frequency. "Time to saddle up, Blue Team," he called out. "RB back at the bunker for orders." 3 blue lights winked acknowledgement in his display. A moment later, the other 3 Spartans in his squad trotted into position.
"Reporting is ordered," Blue 2 announced.
The Master Chief quickly filled them in on the mission. "Blue 2," he nodded to Kelly, "you're carrying the nuke and medical gear."
"Affirmative. Who'll have the detonator, sir?"
"I will," he replied. "Blue 3," he turned to Fred, "you have the explosives. James, you'll take our extra comm equipment." They double-checked their gear. Modified MA-5B assault rifles, adapted to mount silencers, 10 extra clips of ammunition, frag grenades, combat knives, M60 pistols, small but powerful handguns that fired 45 caliber magnum loads, sufficient to crack through grunt armor. In addition to the weapons, there was a single smoke canister, blue smoke to signal for pickup. John would carry that. "Let's go," he said. Blue Team moved out. They quickly entered the jungle, in a simple single-file line, with Blue 4 in the lead. James had an instinct for walking point. The line was slightly staggered, with John and Kelly slightly to the left of James. Fred brought up the rear. They moved cautiously. Every 100 yards, James signaled the group to a halt, while he methodically surveyed the area for any sign of the enemy. The rest of Blue Team crouched and disappeared into the thick jungle foliage. John checked his HUD. They were 1/4 of the way to the city. The team made good time despite the cautious pace. The Mjolnir assault armor allowed them to push their way through the thick jungle like it was a stroll through the woods. As the team moved on, the thin mist that permeated the jungle gave way to a hard, pelting rain. The damp ground gradually turned to mud, forcing the team to slow. Blue 4 stopped dead and raised his fist, the signal to halt and freeze. John stopped in his tracks, his rifle raised and sweeping slowly back and forth, searching for any sign of enemy movement. Normally, the Spartans relied on their armor's detection gear to locate enemy troops, but their motion sensors were useless. Everything moved in the jungle. They had to rely on their eyes and ears and the instincts of their point man. "Point to team leader, enemy contact." James' calm voice crackled across the comm channel. "Enemy troops within 100 meters of my position, 10 degrees left." With exaggerated slowness, Blue 4 indicated the danger area by pointing.
"Affirmative," John replied. "Blue team, hold position."
Although the motion trackers were of no use here, thermal proved effective. Through the thick sheets of rain, the Master Chief spotted 3 cold spots, grunts in their chilled environmental suits.
"Blue team, enemy contact confirmed."
He added the enemy position to his HUD.
"Estimated enemy strength point?"
"Lead, I make 10. Say again, 10 Covenant troops. Grunt, sir. They're moving slowly. Double file formation. They haven't spotted us. Orders?"
John's orders said to minimize contact with the enemy where possible. The Spartans were spread too thinly across the battle area to risk a prolonged engagement, but the grunts were heading right for the Marine bunker.
"Let's take them out, Blue Team," he said.
The team of grunts slogged through the mud. The vaguely simian aliens wore shiny red-trimmed armor. Craggy purple-black hide was visible beneath the environmental suits. Breath masks provided super-cooled methane, the aliens' atmosphere. There were 10 of them, moving in 2 columns, spaced roughly 3 meters apart. John noted with satisfaction that they seemed bored. Only the point man and the pair on rear guard had their plasma rifles at the ready. The rest chattered at each other in a weird combination of high-pitched squeaks and guttural barks.
Easy, relaxed targets. Perfect. He gave a series of slow hand signals to the rest of the team. They faded back until they were well away from the grunt's field of view.
The Master Chief opened the squad-wide comm channel. They're 70 meters from this depression. He keyed a nav point into the team's topographic display. They're heading for the western hill, and will probably follow the terrain to the top. We'll fall back now and take concealed positions along the eastern hill. Blue Four, you're our scout. Stay near the bottom and let us know when the rear guard passes you. Take them out first. They seem alert. Blue Two, you have overwatch at the top of the hill. Blue Three, back me up. Silenced weapons only. No explosives, unless things go bad. He paused, then gave the order. Move out!
The Spartans crept back along their path and spread out along the hill. John, in the center of the line, readied his assault rifle. The team was virtually invisible in the thick foliage and covered by the barrel-wide tree trunks of the local flora. 1 minute ticked by, then two, three. Blue Four's acknowledgement signal blinked twice in John's HUD. Enemy detected. He relaxed his grip on the weapon, waiting. There. 20 meters distant, the grunt point man moved to the edge of the western hill, just downhill from John's position. The alien paused, his plasma rifle sweeping the area, then moved slowly up the rise. A moment later, the rest of the formation came into view, 10 meters behind the point man. Blue Four's indicator winked again. Now. The Master Chief opened fire, a short 3-round burst. The weapon's muffled cough was inaudible over the sound of jungle rainfall. The trio of armor-piercing rounds slashed through the alien's throat protection, rupturing the environment suit. The grunt clutched at his neck, emitted a brief high-pitched gurgle, then fell to the mud, dead. A moment later, the grunt lines came to a clumsy halt, confused. John spotted 2 strobe flashes, and the pair of Covenant rear guards dropped to the ground. Blue Two to lead, rear guard eliminated.
Hit them! John barked.
The 4 Spartans opened fire in short bursts. In less than a second, 4 more of the grunt patrol were down, dead from headshots. The remaining trio of grunts unslung their plasma rifles, swinging them wildly back and forth, looking for targets and chattering loudly in their strange barking language. John sighted on the alien closest to him and squeezed the trigger. The alien splashed into the mud, methane bubbling from his shattered breath mask. Another pair of sustained bursts, and the last of the grunts were down. Kelly policed the grunts' weapons and handed a plasma rifle to each of the team. The Spartans had standing orders to seize Covenant weapons and technology whenever possible. Blue Team fanned out and continued on their way. When they heard banshees overhead, they hunkered down in the mud, and the flyers passed. 10 more kilometers of rough terrain, and then the jungle stopped, and fields of rice paddies stretched out before them all the way to Côte d'Azur. Crossing these would be more difficult than the jungle. They donned camouflage cloaks that masked their thermal signatures and crawled through the muck on their stomachs. The Master Chief saw 3 larger ships hovering over the city. If they were troop transports, they could carry thousands of Covenant soldiers. If they were warships, any direct ground assault against the city would be futile. Either way, it was bad news. He made sure his vid and audio mission recorders got a good, clear image of the vessels. When they emerged from the mud, they were near the beach on the edge of the city. The Master Chief checked his map readings and made his way to the sewage outlet. The 2-meter diameter pipe was sealed with a steel grate. He and Fred easily bent the bars aside and entered. They sloshed through hip-deep muck. The Master Chief didn't like the cramped quarters. Their mobility was restricted by the narrow pipes. Worse, they were bunched up and therefore easier to kill with grenades or massed fire. Motion sensors picked up hundreds of targets. The constant downpour from storm drains above made the sensors useless. He followed his electronic map through the maze of pipes. Light filtered in from above.
beams of illumination connected to the manhole cover vent holes. Every so often something moved and blocked that light. The Spartans moved quickly and quietly through the sludge and halted when they reached their final waypoint, directly under the center of Côte d'Azur's downtown. With a tiny jerk of his head, the Master Chief informed Blue Team to spread out and keep their eyes peeled. He snaked a fiber-optic probe up through the drain gate at street level and plugged it into his helmet. The yellow light from the sodium vapor lamps washed everything topside in an eerie glow. There were grunts positioned on the street corners, and the shadow of a Banshee flyer circling overhead. The electric cars parked on the street had been overturned, and the waste receptacles had been knocked over or set on fire. Every street-level window was broken. The Master Chief saw no human civilians, alive or otherwise. Blue Team moved up and over a block. The Master Chief checked topside again. There was more activity here. A pack of black-armored grunts meandered down the streets. Two vulture-headed jackals sat on the corner, squabbling over a hunk of meat. Something else caught his attention, though. There were other aliens on the sidewalk, or rather, above the sidewalk. They were roughly man-sized creatures, unlike any he had ever encountered. The creatures were vaguely slug-like, with pale purple-pink skin. Unlike other Covenant forces, they were not bipeds. Instead, they had several tentacular appendages sprouting from their thick trunks. They floated a half meter above the ground, as if the odd pink bladders on their backs kept them aloft. One alien used a slender tentacle to open the hood of a car. It began to disassemble the car's electric engine, moving with startling speed. Within 20 seconds, all the parts had been neatly arranged in rows on the pavement. The creature paused, then reassembled the parts with blinding quickness, disassembled and rebuilt it several times into different arrangements. Finally, the creature simply reassembled the car and floated on its way. The Master Chief made sure his mission recorder had gotten that. This was a Covenant race never documented before. He rotated the fiber-optic cable to point down the opposite end of the street. There was more activity another block away. He retracted the probe and moved Blue Team a block farther south. He signaled the team to hold position, then climbed up a short series of metal handholds until he was just below a manhole cover. He cautiously sent the probe topside again, up through the manhole cover vent. There was a jackal's hoof directly adjacent to the probe, blocking half of his field of vision. He turned the probe with excruciating slowness and saw 50 more jackals milling back and forth. They were concentrated around the building across the street. The building resembled pictures that Deja had shown him years ago. It looked like an Athenian temple with white marble steps and Ionic columns. At the top of the steps were a pair of stationary guns. More bad news. He pulled the probe back and consulted the map. The building was marked as the Côte d'Azur Museum of Natural History. The Covenant had serious firepower here. The stationary guns had commanding fields of fire, making a frontal assault suicidal. Why would they protect a human structure, he wondered. Was it their headquarters? The Master Chief signaled for Blue Two. He pointed to the access way that led under the building. He held up two fingers, pointed toward her eyes, and then down the passage, and then slowly balled his hand into a fist. Kelly proceeded very slowly down that passage to scout it out. The Master Chief checked the time. Red and green teams were due to report. He had James attach the ground return transceiver to the pipes overhead.
Green Team, come in.
Roger. Green Team leader here, sir, Linda whispered over the channel. We've scouted the residential section.
There was a pause.
No survivors. Just like Draco 3. We're too late.
He understood. They'd seen it before. The Covenant didn't take prisoners. On Draco 3, they had watched via satellite link-up as human survivors were herded together
and ripped apart by ravenous grunts and jackals. By the time the Spartans had gotten there, there was no one left to rescue. But the victims had been avenged.
"Green team, stand by and prepare to fall back to the RV and secure the area," he said.
"Standing by," Linda said.
He switched to the Red Team comm channel.
"Red Team, report."
Joshua's voice crackled over the link.
"Red Leader, sir. We've got something for ONI. We've spotted some new type of Covenant race. Little guys that float. They seem to be some sort of a explorer or scientist type. They take things apart, then move on, like they're looking for something. They do not, repeat not, appear hostile. Advise that you do not engage. They raise a pretty loud alarm, Blue Lead."
"You in trouble?"
"Dodge trouble, sir," he said. "But there is one snag."
Snag. The word was charged with meaning for the Spartans. Getting caught in an ambush or a minefield, a teammate wounded, or aerial bombardments. Those were all things they had trained for. Snags were things they didn't know how to handle. Complications that no one had planned for.
"Go ahead," the Master Chief whispered.
"We have survivors. 20 civilians hit in a cargo ship here. There are several wounded."
The Master Chief mulled this over. It wasn't his choice to weigh the relative worth of a handful of civilian lives versus the possibility of taking out 10,000 Covenant troops with their nuke. His orders were specific on this point. They could not set up the nuke if there was civilian population at risk.
"New mission objective, Red Team Leader," the Master Chief said. "Get those civilians to the recovery point and evac them back to fleet."
He switched comm channels again, broadcasting to all the teams.
"Green Team Leader, you still online?"
A pause. Then Linda spoke.
"Roger."
"Move to the docks and coordinate with Red Team. They have survivors we need to evac. Green Team Leader has strategic control of this mission."
"Understood," she said.
"We're on our way."
"Affirmative, sir,"
Joshua said.
"We'll get it done."
"Blue Team out."
The Master Chief disconnected.
It was going to be rough for Green and Red Teams. Those civilians would slow them down. And if they had to protect them from Covenant patrols, they'd all get noticed. Blue 2 returned. She opened the comlink and reported in.
"There's access to the building. A ladder and a steel plate welded shut. We can burn through it."
The Master Chief opened up the team comm channel.
"We're going to assume that Red and Green teams will remove the civilians from Côte d'Azur. We will proceed as planned."
He paused, then turned to Blue 2. "Break out the nuke and arm it."
Chapter 21. 2120 hours, July 18th, 2542, military calendar. UNSC Iroquois, military staging area in orbit around Sigma Octanus IV.
"Ship status," Captain Keyes said as he strode onto the bridge, buttoning his collar.
He noticed that the repair station cradle still obscured their port camera.
"And why aren't we clear of that station yet?"
"Sir, all hands are at battle stations," Lieutenant Dominique replied. "General quarters sounded. TAC data uploaded to your station."
A tactical overview of the Iroquois, neighboring vessels, and cradle popped onto Key's personal display screen.
"As you can see," Lieutenant Dominique continued, "we did clear the station, but they are moving on the same outbound vector we are. Admiral Stanforth wants them with the fleet."
Captain Keyes took his place in his command chair, the hot seat, as it was more colloquially known, and reviewed the data. He nodded with satisfaction.
"Looks like the Admiral has something up his sleeve."
He turned to Lieutenant Hall.
"Engine status, Lieutenant?"
"Engine's hot at 50%, she reported.
She straightened to her full height, nearly 6 feet, and looked Captain Keyes in the eye with something edging near defensiveness.
"Sir, the engines took a real beating in our last engagement. The repairs we've made are, well, the best we could do without a complete refit."
"Understood, Lieutenant," Keyes replied calmly.
In truth, Keyes was concerned about the engines, too. But it would do no good to make Hall more uneasy than necessary. The last thing he needed now was to undermine her confidence.
"Gunnery officer?"
Captain Keyes turned to Lieutenant Hakawa. The petite woman bore more resemblance to a porcelain doll than to a combat officer, but Keyes knew her delicate appearance was only skin-deep. She had ice water for blood and nerves of steel.
"Mac guns charging," Lieutenant Hikawa reported. 65% and climbing at 2% per minute."
Everything in the Iroquois had slowed down to a crawl. Engine, weapons, even the unwieldy cradle kept pace with them. Captain Keyes sat up straighter. There was no time to spend on self-recriminations. He would have to do the best he could with what he had. There was simply no other alternative. The lift doors popped open, and a young man stepped on deck. He was tall and thin. His dark hair, longer than regulations permitted, had been slicked back. He was disarmingly handsome. Keyes noticed the female bridge crew pause to look the newcomer over before returning to their tasks.
"Ensign Lovell reporting for duty, Captain."
He snapped a sharp salute.
"Welcome aboard, Ensign Lovell."
Captain Keyes returned a salute, surprised that the unkempt officer could demonstrate such crisp adherence to military protocol.
"Man the navigation console, please."
The bridge officers scrutinized the ensign. It was highly unusual for such a low-ranking officer to pilot a capital ship.
"Sir?"
Lovell wrinkled his forehead, confused.
"Has there been some mistake, sir?"
"You are Ensign Michael Lovell, recently posted on the Archimedes remote sensor outpost?"
"Yes, sir. They pulled me off that duty so quick that I—"
"Then man your station, Ensign."
"Yes, sir."
Ensign Lovell sat at the navigation console, took a few seconds to acquaint himself with the controls, then reconfigured them more to his liking. A slight smile tugged at the corner of Key's mouth. He knew that Lovell had more combat experience than any lieutenant on the bridge, and was pleased that the ensign adapted so quickly to unfamiliar surroundings.
"Show me the fleet's position and the relative location of the enemy, Ensign," Keyes ordered.
"Aye, sir,"
Lovell replied. His hands danced across the controls. A moment later, a system map snapped into place on the main screen. Dozens of small triangular tactical markers showed Admiral Stanforth's fleet massing between Sigma Octanus IV and its moon. It was a sound opening position. Fighting in orbit around Sigma Octanus IV would have trapped them in the gravity well, like fighting with your back to a wall. Keyes studied the display and frowned. The Admiral had moved the fleet into a tightly packed grid formation. When the Covenant fired their plasma weapons at them, there would be no maneuvering room. The Covenant was moving in-system quickly. Captain Keyes counted 20 radar signatures. He didn't like the odds.
"Receiving orders," Lieutenant Dominique said. "Admiral Stanforth wants the Iroquois at this location, ASAP."
On the map, a blue triangle pulsed on the corner of the grid formation.
"Ensign Lovell, get us there at best speed."
"Aye, sir,"
he replied. Captain Keyes fought down a wave of embarrassment. The cradle Stardock started to pull ahead of the Iroquois. It took up a position directly over the Admiral's phalanx formation. The refit station rotated, presenting its edge to the incoming Covenant fleet to show them the smallest target area.
"Rotating and reversing burn,"
Ensign Lovell said. The Iroquois spun about and slowed.
"Thrusters to station keeping. We're locked in position, sir."
"Very good, Ensign. Lieutenant Hikawa, divert as much power as you need to get those MAC guns charged."
"Aye, sir," Hikawa replied. "Capacitors charging at maximum rate."
"Captain," Lieutenant Dominique said, "we're receiving an encrypted firing solution and countdown timers from the Leviathan's AI.
Transfer that vector to Lieutenant Hikawa and show me on screen."
A line appeared on the tactical map, connecting the Iroquois to one of the incoming Covenant frigates. The firing timer appeared in the corner. 23 seconds.
"Now show me the entire fleet's firing solutions, Lieutenant Dominique."
A web of trajectories crossed the map with tiny countdown times next to each. Admiral Stanforth had the fleet exchanging fire with the Covenant, like a line of redcoats and colonial militia in the Revolutionary War. Tactics that could best be described as bloody or suicidal. What the hell was the Admiral thinking?
Keyes studied the displays, trying to divine a method to his commanding officer's madness. Then he understood. Risky, but if it worked, brilliant. The fleet's firing countdowns were roughly timed so that the shots would be staggered into two, maybe three, massive salvos. The first salvo would, hopefully, knock out the Covenant ship's shields. The final salvo was to be the knockout punch. But it could only work once. After that, the UNSC fleet would be destroyed when the remaining Covenant ships returned fire. The Iroquois and the other ships were stationary targets. He appreciated that the Admiral couldn't get too far from Sigma Octanus IV, but with zero momentum and no room to maneuver, there'd be no way to avoid those plasma bolts.
"Sound decompression alarms in all non-essential sections, Lieutenant Hall, and then empty them."
"Aye, sir," she said, and bit her lower lip.
"Guns, status on the max?"
Key's eyes were glued to the firing countdown. 20 seconds. 15. 10.
"Sir, MAC weapon systems are hot," Hikawa announced. "Removing safeties now."
The Covenant ships started to rotate slowly in space, although their momentum continued to carry them on their inbound trajectory toward the UNSC phalanx. Motes of red light collected along the alien ship's lateral lines. 5 seconds.
"Transferring firing control to the computer," Lieutenant Hikawa said.
She punched a series of firing codes into the computer, then locked down the controls. The Iroquois recoiled and spat twin bolts of thunder toward the enemy. The starboard view screen showed UNSC destroyers and frigates launching their opening salvo. The Covenant fleet fired as well. Angry red lances of energy raced through space towards them.
"Time until that plasma impacts?" Captain Keyes asked Ensign Lovell.
22 seconds, sir."
The vacuum between the two opposing forces filled with 100 lines of fire and smoldering metal that seemed to tear through the fabric of space. Their trajectories closed on one another, then crossed, and the bolts of fire grew larger on the main screen.
Lieutenant Dominique said, "Receiving a second set of firing solutions and times. Admiral Stanforth on the priority channel, sir."
"Put 'em on, holotank 2, Keyes ordered.
Near the main view screen, a small holographic tank, normally reserved for the ship's AI, winked into operation. Admiral Stanforth's ghostly image appeared.
"All ships, hold your positions. Divert all engine power to recharge your guns. We've got something special cooked up."
His eyes narrowed.
"Do not, I repeat, do not, under any circumstance, break position or fire before you are ordered to. Stanforth out."
The holographic projection of the Admiral snapped out of existence.
"Order, sir?"
Ensign Lovell turned in his seat.
"You heard the Admiral, Ensign. Thrusters to station keeping. Lieutenant Hikawa, get those guns recharged on the double."
"Aye, sir."
Keyes nodded as Hikawa turned back to her task.
3 seconds until first salvo impact," she announced.
Keyes turned back to the TAC display, concentrating on the macrounds that crawled across the screen. The fleet's macrounds hammered into the Covenant lines. Shields flickered silver-blue and overloaded as the super-dense projectiles rammed into the formation. Several ships were spun out of position by the impact.
"Guns," he called out. "Enemy status."
"Multiple hits on Covenant fleet, sir," Hikawa replied. "Salvo 2 impact, now!"
A handful of the shots were clean misses. Keyes winced. Each one of the off-trajectory MAC rounds meant one more enemy ship would survive to return fire. The vast majority, however, slammed into the unshielded alien vessels. The lead Covenant destroyer took a direct hit from a heavy round, which sent the alien ship into a lurching port spin. Keyes saw the destroyer's engines flare as her pilot struggled to regain control, just as a second MAC round struck on the ship's opposite side. For an instant, the Covenant vessel shuddered, held position, then flexed as the hull stresses became too great. The destroyer disintegrated and scattered debris in a wide arc. A second Covenant ship, a frigate,
shuddered under the impact of multiple MAC rounds. It listed to starboard and ran the next frigate in the enemy formation. Sparks and small explosions flared from the ships as a gray-white plume of vented atmosphere exploded into space. The ship's running lights flickered, then dimmed, as the pair of dead spacecraft, locked in a deadly embrace, tumbled into the heart of the Covenant line. A moment later, the wrecked ships hit a third Covenant frigate, and they exploded, sending tendrils of plasma through space. A dozen of their ships vented atmosphere, and fires flickered within their hulls. The four-view screen, however, was now filled with incoming weapons fire.
"Fleet Commander on priority channel," Dominique announced. "Audio only."
"Patch it through, Lieutenant," Keyes ordered.
A hiss of static crackled through the communication system speakers. A moment later, Admiral Stanforth's voice calmly broke through the noise.
"Lead to all ships. Hold your positions," the Admiral said. "Make ready to fire. Transfer timers to your computers, and hang on to your hats."
A shadow crossed the overhead camera. On the view screen, Captain Keyes watched as the cradle repair station, the plate nearly a kilometer on edge, rotated and started to slide in front of their phalanx formation.
"Christ," Anson Lovell whispered. "They're gonna take the hits for us."
"Dominique, hit the scopes. Are there any life pods outbound from Cradle?"
Keyes asked. He already knew the answer.
"Sir," Dominique answered, his deep voice thick with worry. "No escape craft have left the Cradle."
All eyes on the Iroquois bridge were riveted to the screen. Keyes' hands clenched with anger and helplessness. There was nothing to do but watch. The front view screen went black as the station passed in front of them. Pinpoints of red and orange appeared along the back surface, metal vapor venting in plumes. Cradle lurched closer to the fleet, the impact of the plasma torpedoes pushing it back. The station continued to move downward, spreading out the damage. Holes appeared in the surface. The internal lattice of steel girders was exposed and, seconds later, glowed white-hot. Then the view screen was clear again.
"Ventral cameras," Captain Keyes said. "Now!"
The view changed as Dominique switched to the Iroquois belly cameras. Cradle Station reappeared. She spun, and her entire forward surface was aglow. Heat spread to the edges, the center liquefied, and pulled away.
"MAC guns ready to fire in 3 seconds,"
Lieutenant Hikawa announced, her voice cold and angry.
"Targeting lock acquired."
Keyes gripped the arms of the command chair.
"Cradle's crew bought this shot for us, Lieutenant," Captain Keyes growled. "Make it count."
The Iroquois shuddered as the MAC gun fired. On the status display, Keyes watched as the rest of the UNSC fleet fired simultaneously. A 21-gun salute, 3 times over, for those on board the station who had given their lives.
"All ships, break and attack!"
Admiral Stanforth bellowed.
"Pick your targets and fire at will! Take as many of these bastards out as you can! Stanforth out!"
They had to move before the Covenant plasma weapons recharged.
"Give me 50% on our engines," Captain Keyes ordered, "and come about to course 280.
"Aye,"
Ensign Lovell and Lieutenant Hall replied in unison.
"Lieutenant Hikawa, release safeties on the Archer missile system."
"Safeties disengaged, sir."
The Iroquois moved away at a near right angle from the phalanx formation. The other UNSC ships scattered at all vectors. One UNSC destroyer, the Lancelot, accelerated straight toward the Covenant line. As the UNSC ships scattered, the MAC salvo reached the Covenant ships. The Admiral's firing solutions had targeted the remainder of the Covenant battlegroup's smaller ships. Their shields sparkled, rippled, and then flickered out of existence. Their frigates shattered under the impact of the firepower. Holes ripped through their hulls. Wrecked spacecraft drifted lazily through the battle area. The surprise second salvo had cost the Covenant dearly. A dozen enemy ships were out of the fight. That left 8 Covenant vessels, destroyers and cruisers.
pulse lasers and Archer missiles fired, and every ship on screen accelerated towards one another. Both Covenant and UNSC ships released their single-ship fighters. The TAC computer was having trouble tracking everything. Keyes cursed to himself over the lack of a ship AI, as the missile fire and plasma discharges strobed in the blackness. Single ships, the humans' longsword fighters, and the flat, vaguely Piscine Covenant fighters, dove and fired, and impacted into warships. Archer missiles left trails of exhaust. Blue pulse lasers scattered inside the clouds of vented propellant and atmosphere, and cast a ghostly blue glow over the scene.
"Order, sir?"
Lovell asked nervously. Captain Keyes paused. Something felt wrong. The battle was utter chaos, and it was nearly impossible to tell exactly what was happening. Sensor data was thrown off by the constant detonations and fire of the aliens' energy weapons.
"Scan near the planet, Lieutenant Hall," Keyes said. "Ensign Lovell, move us closer to Sigma Octanus IV."
"Sir?" Lieutenant Dominique said. "We are not engaging the Covenant fleet?"
"Negative, Lieutenant."
The bridge crew paused for a fraction of a second, all except Ensign Lovell, who tapped on the controls and plotted a new course. The bridge crew had all had a taste of being heroes in their last battle, and they wanted more. Captain Keyes knew what that was like. And he knew how dangerous it was. He was not about to charge into battle, however, with the Iroquois at half power, her structural integrity already compromised, and with no AI to mount a point defense against Covenant single ships. One plasma torpedo to their lower decks would gut them. If he remained where he was and attempted to shoot into the fray, he was just as likely to accidentally hit a friendly ship as a Covenant vessel. No. There were several damaged Covenant ships in the area. He would finish them off, make sure they could not launch any attack on their fleet. There was no glory in the action, but considering their present condition, glory was of little concern. Survival was. Captain Keyes watched the battle rage in the starboard camera. The Leviathan took a plasma bolt, and her four decks burned. One Covenant ship collided with the UNSC frigate Fairweather. The superstructures of the two craft locked together, and both ships opened fire at point-blank range. The Fairweather detonated into a ball of nuclear fire that engulfed the Covenant destroyer. Both ships faded from the tactical display.
"Covenant ship detected in orbit around Sigma Octanus IV," Lieutenant Hall reported.
"Let me see it," Keyes said.
A small vessel appeared on screen. It was smaller than the Covenant equivalent of a frigate, but definitely larger than one of the aliens' dropships. It was sleek and seemed to waver in and out of the blankness of space. The engine pods were baffled and devoid of the characteristic purple-white glow of Covenant propulsion systems.
"They're in a geosynchronous orbit over Côte d'Azur," Lieutenant Hall reported. "Their thrusters are firing microbursts. Precision station-keeping, sir, if I were to guess."
Lieutenant Dominique interrupted.
"Detected scattering from a narrow-beam transmission on the planet's surface, sir. A far infrared laser."
Captain Keyes turned toward the main battle on screen. Was this slaughter just a diversion? The original attack on Sigma Octanus IV had been for the sole purpose of landing ships and invading Côte d'Azur. Once accomplished, their battle group had left. And now, whatever the Covenant's purpose was groundside, they were sending information to the stealth ship, while the rest of their fleet kept the UNSC forces from interfering.
"Like hell," he muttered.
"Ensign Lovell, plot a collision course for that ship."
"Aye, sir."
"Lieutenant Hall, push the engines as far as you can. I need every bit of speed you can get me." "Yes, sir. If we vent primary coolant and use our reserve, I can boost the engine output to 66% for 5 minutes.
"Do it."
The Iroquois moved sluggishly toward the Covenant ship.
"Intercept in 20 seconds, Lovell said.
"Lieutenant Hikawa, arm Archer missile pods A through D. Blow that Covenant son of a bitch out of the sky."
"Archer missile pods armed, sir," she replied smoothly.
Her hands moved gracefully over the controls.
"Firing."
Archer missiles streaked toward the Covenant stealth ship.
but as they closed with the target, they started to swerve from side to side, then spun out of control. The spent missiles fell toward the planet. Lieutenant Hikawa cursed quietly in Japanese.
"Missile guidance locks jammed," she said. "Their ECM spoofed the guidance packages, sir."
No other choice, then, Keyes thought. They can jam our missiles. Let's see them jam this.
"Run them over, Ensign Lovell," Keyes ordered.
He licked his lips.
"Aye, sir."
"Sound collision alarm," Captain Keyes said. "All hands, brace for impact."
"She's moving,"
Lovell said.
"Keep on her. Course correcting now. Hang on," Lovell said.
The 8,000-ton Iroquois slammed into the tiny Covenant ship. On the bridge, they barely felt the impact. The diminutive alien vessel, however, was crushed from the force. Her crippled hull spun towards Sigma Octanus IV.
"Damage report,"
Keyes bellowed.
"Lower decks 3 through 8 show hull breach, sir,"
Hall called out.
"Internal bulkheads were already closed, and no one was in those areas, per your orders. No systems damage reported."
"Good. Move to her original position, Ensign Lovell. Lieutenant Dominique, I want that transmission beam intercepted."
The ventral cameras showed the Covenant ship plunge into the atmosphere. Its shield glowed yellow, then white, then dissipated as the ship's systems failed. It burst into crimson flame and burned across the horizon, a black plume of smoke trailing in its wake.
"The Iroquois is losing altitude," Ensign Lovell said. "We're falling into the planet's atmosphere, bringing us about."
The Iroquois spun 180 degrees. The ensign concentrated on his displays, then said,
"No good. We need more power. Sir, permission to fire emergency thrusters?"
"Granted."
Lovell exploded the aft emergency thrusters, and the Iroquois jumped. Lovell's eyes were locked on the repeater displays as he fought for every centimeter of maneuvering he could get. Sweat ran down his forehead and soaked his flight suit.
"Orbit stabilizing."
"Barely." Lovell exhaled with relief, then turned to face Keyes.
"Got it, sir. Thrusters to precision station keeping."
"Receiving,"
Lieutenant Dominique said, and then paused.
"Receiving something, sir. It must be encrypted."
"Make sure you're recording, Lieutenant."
"Affirmative. Recorder's active, but the codebreaker software can't crack it, sir."
Captain Keyes turned back to the TAC displays, half expecting to see a Covenant ship in firing position. There wasn't much left of either the Covenant or UNSC fleets. Dozens of ships drifted in space, billowing atmosphere and burning. The rest moved slowly. A few flickered with fire. Scattered explosions dotted the black. One undamaged Covenant destroyer turned, however, and left the battlefield. It came about and headed straight for the Iroquois.
"Uh-oh," Lovell muttered.
"Lieutenant Hall, get me the Leviathan, priority Alpha Channel," Keyes ordered.
"Yes, sir,"
she said. Admiral Stanforth's image appeared in the holotank. His forehead had a gash across it, and blood trickled into his eyes. He wiped it away with a shaking hand, his eyes blazing with anger.
"Keyes, where the hell is Iroquois?"
"Sir, Iroquois is in geosynchronous orbit over Côte d'Azur. We've destroyed a Covenant stealth ship and are in process of intercepting a secure transmission from the planet."
The Admiral stared at him a moment, unbelievingly, then nodded as if this made sense to him.
"Proceed."
"We have a Covenant destroyer leaving the battle, bearing down on us. I think the reason for the Covenant's invasion may be in this coded transmission, and they don't want us to know, sir."
"Understood, son. Hang on. The cavalry's on its way."
On the aft screen, the remaining 8 UNSC ships broke their attacks and turned toward the incoming destroyer. 3 MAC guns fired and impacted on the Covenant vessel. Its shields only lapsed for a split second. It took a round through her nose, but it continued toward the Iroquois at flank speed.
"Transmission ended, sir," Lieutenant Dominique announced. "Cut off in mid-packet. The signal was terminated at the source."
"Damn!"
Captain Keyes considered staying and trying to reacquire that signal, but only for a moment. He decided to take what they had and run with it.
Ensign Lovell, get us the hell out of here.
Sir,
Lieutenant Hall said. Look!
The Covenant destroyer was changing course, along with the rest of the surviving Covenant vessels. They were scattering and accelerating out of the system.
They're running,
Lieutenant Hikawa said, her normal iron calm replaced by astonishment. Within minutes, the Covenant ships accelerated and vanished into slipstream space. Captain Keyes looked aft and counted only 7 UNSC ships intact, with the balance of the fleet destroyed or disabled. He sat in his command chair.
Ensign Lovell, take us back the way we came. Make ready to take on wounded. Repressurize all uncompromised decks.
Jesus, Lieutenant Hall said. I think we actually won that one.
Yes, Lieutenant, we won, Keyes replied.
But Captain Keyes wondered exactly what they had won. The Covenant had come to this system for a reason, and he had a sinking feeling that they may have gotten what they had come for. Chapter 22 2010 hours, July 18, 2542, military calendar. Sigma Octanus 4, Côte d'Azur. It was time to arm the nuke. The small device held the power to destroy Côte d'Azur, wipe the Covenant infection clean off the planet. John carefully removed the bonding strips on the Havoc tactical nuclear device and attached it to the wall of the sewer. The adhesive on the black half-sphere stuck and hardened to the concrete. He slipped the detonator key into a thin slot on the unit's face. There were no external indicators on the device. Instead, a tiny screen winked on his heads-up display, indicating the nuke was armed. "Havoc armed," flashed across his HUD. "Awaiting detonation signal." The device, a clean 30-megaton explosive, could only be detonated by a remote signal. A problem here in the sewers. Even the powerful communications package on a starship would be unable to penetrate the steel and concrete overhead. John quickly rigged a ground-return transceiver, placing it on the pipes overhead. He'd have to set up another unit outside to relay the signal underground. A hotline that would trigger a nuclear firestorm. Technically, his mission parameters had been fulfilled. Green and red teams would have the civilians evacuated soon. They had scouted the region and discovered a new Covenant species, the strange floating creature that disassembled and reassembled human machinery, like a scientist or engineer stripping down a device to learn its secrets. He could leave and destroy the Covenant occupation force. He should leave. There was an army of jackals and grunts, including at least a platoon of the black-armored veterans, on the streets above. There were 3 medium Covenant dropships hovering in the air as well. The advanced Marine strike forces had been slaughtered, leaving the Spartans no backup. His responsibility now was to make sure his team got out intact. But John's orders had an unusual amount of flexibility, and that made him uncomfortable. He had been told to reconnoiter the region and gather intelligence on the Covenant. He was positive there was more to be learned here. Certainly they were up to something in Côte d'Azur's museum. The Covenant had never before been interested in human history, or indeed in humans or their artifacts of any kind. He had seen a disarmed jackal fight hand to hand rather than pick up a nearby human assault rifle, and the only thing the Covenant had ever used human buildings for was target practice. So finding out the reason they seized and were protecting the museum definitely qualified as intelligence gathering in his book. Was it worth exposing his team to find out? And if they died, would he be wasting their lives or spending them for something worthwhile?
Master Chief, Kelly whispered. Our orders, sir.
He opened Blue Team's comm channel. We're going in. Use your silencers. Don't engage the enemy unless absolutely necessary. This place is too hot. We'll just poke our noses in, see what they're up to, and bug out. 3 acknowledgement lights winked on. The Master Chief knew they implicitly trusted his judgment. He just hoped he was worthy of that trust. The Spartans checked their gear and threaded silencers onto their assault rifles. They slipped silently down a wide side passage of the sewer. A rusty ladder ran up to the ceiling, and a steel plate had been welded in place.
"Thermite paste already set up," Fred reported.
"Burn it." The Master Chief stepped to the side and looked away. The thermite sputtered as bright as an electric arc welder, casting harsh shadows into the chamber. When it finished, there was a jagged, glowing red circle in the steel. The Master Chief climbed up the ladder and put his back against the plate. Pushed. It popped free with a metallic snap. He eased the plate down and set it aside. He attached the fiber optic probe, fed it up through the hole. All clear. He flexed his leg muscles and sent the Mjolnir armor up through the hole, pulling himself into the next chamber with his left hand. His right hand held the silenced assault rifle as if it were no heavier than a pistol. He braced for incoming enemy fire. Nothing happened. He moved forward and surveyed the small room. The stone-walled chamber was dark and was lined with shelving units. Each unit held jars filled with clear liquid and insect specimens. Boxes and crates were stacked neatly on the floor. Kelly entered next, then Fred and James.
"Picking up motion sensor signals,"
Kelly said over the comm channel. "Jam them."
"Done,"
she replied.
"They may have gotten a piece of us, though."
"Spread out," the Master Chief ordered.